we could prove an epoch-making planetary exploration through autonomous navigation and guidance and stand foremost in the world in deep space exploration technology. You are listening to Western World. Hello, and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Dr. John, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University, at this minute, 851 light seconds from Meridiani Planum in London, Ontario, Canada. Space is so vast that even exploring our nearest celestial neighbors, the planets, poses difficult challenges. One of those challenges is light-time delay. For us, 300,000 kilometers per second makes events anywhere on the Earth occur with apparent simultaneity. But when you send a message to a robot or to an astronaut located on the moon, you need to wait at least 3 seconds or so just for your words to reach that explorer and for their reply to return. Such a delay is enough to be noticeable, and it makes teleoperation of roving vehicles and other tasks difficult. Can you imagine driving a car down the highway with a 3-second delay between when you turn the wheel and the car actually responding? Heading out to the planets vastly increases this delay. For Cassini at Saturn, the delay is up to just over 3 hours. For New Horizons at Pluto, it will be 9 hours. And for Voyager 1, the most distant transmitting human artifact, the delay is now over 33 hours. Even for relatively nearby Mars, the light-time delay varies between just over 6 to just under 45 minutes. Thus, there are no true Mars rover drivers, at least not on the Earth. But what if the rovers could drive themselves? This kind of automation can vastly increase the rate at which rovers and other spacecraft far from the Earth can cover ground and do science. As Junichiro Kawaguchi, project manager for the Hayabusa asteroid sample return mission, intimated in our opening quote, such advances in spacecraft automation are critical to improved operation in deep space. One researcher striving to increase the reach of such vehicles is Dr. David R. Thompson of the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory. In his work, he is pushing the boundary of tasks that will happen on board future craft. Can a rover able to select the best path to, for instance, an outcrop, and drive there, then highlight the most interesting targets and perform analysis all without humans in the loop? Interviewing Dr. Thompson tonight is our own resident machine vision expert, Raymond Francis, and our transitioning music is Nerve Center by Vangelis.
Yeah, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Probably everyone listening has seen these pictures that are coming back from spacecraft orbiting Saturn and other places farther in the solar system, and rovers and landers sitting on the surface of Mars. But of course, you can do a lot more than look at those pictures, and you can do a lot more than send them to Earth for interpretation. And you're with the Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
Yep.
In a group where you do something more than that. So which is it?
I'm in the Machine Learning and Instrument Autonomy group.
Okay.
At the Jet Propulsion Lab.
All right.
And we do a wide range of research into machine learning strategies for interpreting data that comes back and finding patterns in the data. And in some cases, actually building smarter instruments to interpret that data a little bit on the spacecraft itself.
So is that what that means when we say machine learning? Is this smart instruments, or what does that mean?
machine learning is it's a branch of computer science. It's sort of an umbrella term that describes a lot of techniques that help machines improve their performance over time. So you can, for example, give a computer some examples of images that you'd like. And in a future set of images, it could maybe do some prioritization of those to see which ones you're likely to enjoy in the future. So companies do this all the time for things like search query results in databases, or whenever you search the internet, there are machine learning algorithms at work to try and figure out what you want to see based on some previous experience supplied by other users or by perhaps your search results in the past.
And so you're applying this on spacecraft.
Yeah, and so machine learning is actually, like I said, it's a fairly broad class of techniques, and it involves lots of statistical modeling. We do pattern recognition, everything from identifying craters on the surface automatically in images to looking for broad regional trends in data. And image prioritization that I mentioned before is one part of that too. So we do this in all sorts of different domains: earth science, robotic applications, terrestrially and in space. But I think perhaps your viewers might be most interested in the space part.
Right, absolutely. So now, do we talk about machine learning? Is this at all similar to the idea of artificial intelligence, or is it something different?
You could think of it as one way to approach artificial intelligence for a system, yeah. And in fact, humans are learning from the moment we're born. This blooming, buzzing confusion of sensory input all around us starts out just that way. And it's only over time that we learn through experience to interpret it and figure out, like, partition the world into discrete objects and so forth. And we're very good at it now, to the point where we can look at an image of Mars and pick out all the different physical objects in that scene. But a two-year-old might not be able to do that as well, and an infant probably can't do it at all. So it's taken us humans this trillion neuron brain and years of experience in order to interpret these Mars images. And we're taking our first baby steps towards letting a machine, a computer, do something similar, again, through learning by experience.
And that's a pretty good analogy, the idea that we expect humans to be able to just look at something and know what it is, but when they start out, they can't do that.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. It's actually a skill that we take for granted. And folks doing, say, face recognition for your camera, right? Took a long time before we found out good ways to do that. And even those algorithms are, for the most part, driven by machine learning techniques.
And even, of course, a human who has learned to do that, to recognize familiar objects, when placed in an unfamiliar scenario, will probably have a lot of trouble with what they expect to recognize.
Perhaps, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So then there's several examples already of this kind of technique being used in space applications.
Mm-hmm.
For example, with the Mars rovers that are at least one of them still running on the surface of Mars. There's a system called Aegis, which allows it to identify certain features and make decisions on board. What can you tell me about that?
Sure. Well, Aegis is a project led by Tara Eslin at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And over the past year or two, have been detecting rocks automatically in images. Now, rocks are really interesting to scientists because the shape and size of a rock can tell you a lot about the local transport mechanisms that brought it there. You can infer things about the local geology just by looking at rocks. And for the most part, planetary geology is all about different kinds of rocks, right?
Absolutely.
So now you can imagine in a rover scenario where you're commanding a rover, giving a rover a single command that it will then execute over the course of a day before it talks to you again. There's a lot that might happen over the course of that day that you couldn't anticipate in advance. A lot of rocks you might encounter that the scientists haven't seen previously, so they wouldn't even know they're present, wouldn't even know they're there. And the rover, when it gets to the end of its traverse, can only communicate everything it saw with just a couple of images, just a handful of images. So you can see the analogy already to the query in the internet search results, right? Where there are a couple things that are of interest, but the vast majority you never get to see, right? So it's up to the system itself in the internet case to decide what the most important images are. And in the case of Mars too, what Aegis enables is now the rover can take a little bit of additional extra data, high resolution images of those targets that are most of interest that the scientists couldn't see, and make sure that the scientist actually does get that data of the high quality target in the next day's downlink, because it can only send back maybe a dozen or two images per command cycle. Aegis is, it's not strictly speaking a machine learning strategy, but it's again pattern recognition in images, mm-hmm. in order to find rocks and enable this new technique.
So in the case of the Opportunity rover driving across the surface, how do we say what is an interesting rock Which are the ones that it's looking for?
And that's a fantastic question. And actually, people will disagree. Human experts will disagree on what the most interesting features are. So it's a challenging problem. And what's even more challenging is coming up with a language to describe all of the things that, all the interesting properties of a rock that people might want to express, right? In such a way that a computer can reliably make those distinctions too. For example, we've come up with a simple preference protocol on Aegis of looking for different attributes of each rock. So for example, the size, the albedo, measures of shape, for example. These are things that computers are pretty good at computing. Once you found the rock in the first place, it's pretty easy to compute the size, the pixel area of the rock, and some rough measures of geologic shape as well. So we've focused on things like that and have done things like looking for dark rocks that are likely to be cobbles or potentially crater ejecta, bright rock that corresponds to perhaps outcrop in the Meridiani, the dunes of Meridiani Planum. There are some cases like that where you can make some very simple distinctions reliably that provide a lot of value added to the scientists, and we tried to focus on those topics.
Now, Aegis wasn't a system that was built into those rovers. This was a later addition, wasn't it?
That's right. It was actually uploaded many years after the initial mission had begun, and indeed followed through the standard mission.
This is one of the advantages we have when we're doing things like this in software, is that even if you can't change the robot, you can change the way it's programmed.
Absolutely. And MER has been a fantastic technology testbed in addition to all the fantastic science that it's brought back.
So then, you can do this on the surface of Mars, and that's a famous case that people have seen. These robots are really well known. But further out in the solar system, we have spacecraft orbiting Saturn, like Cassini, taking pictures of the moons and the rings and everything that is interesting to look at out there. And last year at the Lunar and Planetary Science Conference, you were talking about a system for applying these kinds of intelligent decision-making of images in looking at the moons out there. So what can you tell me about these?
Right. Well, Aegis is a case. Let me start by contrasting with Aegis.
Okay.
So Aegis is a case where the rover's moving and the environment's more or less static. There are a couple of other times where you do get the environment around the rover changing. So there are cases of dust devils, for example, that appear. There's actually been similar science autonomy software uploaded to the rovers to detect dust devils automatically, and that successfully found appearances of dust devils that they hadn't expected in advance and successfully sent those images back. In the case of the outer solar system, there's lots of dynamic phenomena. So, for example, there are plumes from Enceladus and Io, moons of the outer planets that are of great interest to scientists, but you've got to catch them in the act, right?
What are these plumes exactly?
They're different cryovolcanic activities. So in Io, I'm not actually sure what the composition of a plume is, but
right.
it's stuff underneath that gets ejected out into space, basically.
Okay.
And they appear as huge plumes of a material that leave the planet's surface, and you can do things by looking at the composition of the plumes and the high infer properties of the planet. So this phenomenon is really useful, and it's dynamic, right? It doesn't last forever. At the same time, you've got the similar problem of bandwidth. So you can only send back maybe a few images per command cycle, and you've got a long light time delay, hours to get out there and back. You can't just leave the video camera on and collect images all the time. Even if you could, you couldn't send them all back. So this is another case where the system can provide a little bit of intelligent prioritization and identify plumes when they appear to prioritize those images and make sure that the scientists on the ground get to see them. So what I was showing at LPSC last year was a similar system based on pattern recognition in images to identify plumes so that they could be prioritized.
And how well were you able to do that? How effective was the system at finding images with plumes in them?
In the case of circular planets, there's a technique that actually works really well is to just find the planetary disk, mask it out, and then look for bright stuff outside of that. So that's
like
what
the plumes
we tried.
Extending from the spherical body.
Absolutely. So these are simple image processing tasks that can be programmed readily into a computer. And actually, with that technique, we got zero false positives on our training set. So it was pretty good. And even for detecting very small plumes, like plumes just a few pixels in height, could be detected using that sort of technique. And we're also trying it out on images of comets. So comets are another target out there in the solar system that has lots of transient activity and plumes and outgassing and jets and things like that. And for example, when the Rosetta spacecraft encounters a comet in a couple years, then there is anticipated to be lots of outgassing. So you could imagine plume detection being important in that sort of scenario.
So this year at the conference, you're talking about a new system for looking, again, at geology and how to understand automatically what the image is seeing. I think you're calling it TextureCam this time?
Yeah, TextureCam is the name of the project and the
right.
instrument. Yeah.
Okay. And so what does it do?
It's a smart camera is
okay.
one way to think about it. So it's taking many of the same machine learning concepts that I talked about before with Aegis and carrying it forward onto the instrument itself. The idea is to have a camera that can look at geologic surfaces in images, scenes like outcrop, for example, or sediment, rocks, other features of interest, and ascribe some rudimentary classification to those surfaces. So picking out where the layers are in an image, picking out different units of sedimentary material, those sorts of things. And this is helpful because you can use it to build up maps that could serve as concise summaries of things that the rover's seen. But even more important, you could use it to place instruments or to collect additional data during long traverses or single cycle instrument placement scenarios where the scientists on the ground want to tell the robot, go to that outcrop over there and get three spectroscopy measurements of the most interesting things you see. Commanding the robot at that level would let them do reconnaissance a lot faster than they can currently. And the ability to classify these surfaces and scenes would provide that capability to the rover. So it could actually figure out where the targets were when it finally reached the outcrop.
Okay, so like in the current state of the art, you would send the robot towards the outcrop and then take a picture and have people on Earth decide where to put the instruments.
That's right. And it has the advantage that people are in the loop at each stage, mm-hmm. but it's quite slow, as you can imagine. It takes a command cycle to reach the outcrop, and then usually it takes another command cycle to place the instrument, collect the data. Ultimately, all missions are limited in their ultimate science mm-hmm. yield by the lifetime of the spacecraft, right, which is finite.
Right.
And you want to collect all the data you can in that time. And often the targets are very sparse in the environment. So mm-hmm. we've seen, for example, the Opportunity rover travel many kilometers between the biggest targets of opportunity that are located. So in these cases, it might pay off to do some sort of a fast reconnaissance with a little bit of autonomy that could provide extra measurements of those key high-value targets to make sure that the scientists hadn't missed anything on the way. And the faster you can recon, the better the ultimate science yield of the mission.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, particularly in the case of Mars, where these command cycles are on the order of a day. And so if you run something that takes several cycles, you could be looking at a long time to get a simple task done.
That's right.
Conceptually, how far can you go at integrating those steps of instructions? How much could you get done in a command cycle if you had a camera that could map things out like that?
Well, our goal is to improve by a factor of 2 the number of command cycles required to collect certain classes of data. So this would enable better single cycle instrument placement. Ultimately, I mean, one can envision doing much more in future decades, potentially, depending on how fast the flight computers are, how good our cameras and our PGA gets, and how good our machine learning kung fu can be. You could imagine it making even subtler distinctions than just sort of gross textural distinctions like it is now. But of course, we're taking baby steps in
right.
that direction. So our first step is to just provide a good texture-based classification of the scene reliably.
In terms of doing geological classification, what are the challenges? What makes it difficult to classify types of rock that you see in front of you?
Oh, there are a billion different things that make it challenging.
Yeah.
And in fact, when we see a scene mm-hmm. of an outcrop on Mars, we look past all of the things that computers can't. Things mm-hmm. like illumination differences, things like cast shadows. Our eyes are really good at ignoring those details, right? If you were to zoom in on that image and look at the pixel level intensities, it just looks like noise, right? What TextureCam does is it takes examples supplied by a user and then trains its own statistical model of what those low-level pixel differences are and how those correlate with different surfaces of interest. It could find out for itself that, for example, smooth rock surfaces under all sorts of different illumination conditions have these pixel patterns, right? And encoding that in the camera itself will let it actually discriminate smooth surfaces from rough surfaces, which it's not easy to do a priori.
The system would have to be given this experience before it could be used in the field. You'd have to train it like that.
Absolutely. And in fact, we're no longer programming the system. We're essentially teaching it through Photoshop. So we go through our image of Mars terrain, for example, and paint over all the rocks in the scene to tell the system, these are called rocks. These things are called outcrops. This is sediment, right? Simple stuff like that. And you feed it all this training data, and the statistical machine learning algorithms figure out what the key correlations are that will let it reproduce those same labels for a new scene.
So you talked about lighting conditions, shadows, dust. What else gets in the way? What else are humans able to easily ignore that computer systems would be challenged by?
Well, we've got a great autofocus.
Yeah,
for one.
Of course.
Our eyes actually move. We have a very narrow field of view with high resolution. So we're aware of things in the periphery of our field of view, and sort of our eyes dart to wherever the most interesting places are. And we tend to know intuitively where those are, such that the world seems much higher resolution than we're actually sensing. So that's another capability that humans have that the robot doesn't have. Humans are good at recognizing objects at varying ranges and under different orientations, too. So we know what a chair looks like, even if we see it upside down. Now, in order to train a system to recognize that chair using just training examples, it might take a lot of training data to exhaust all the possible orientations of the chair. So this forces us to be really clever in terms of the way we present data to the system and exactly what distinctions we try and train it to recognize.
And cover all the cases of things that are reasonably likely, I guess.
Absolutely. It takes large training sets in order to generalize to new environments.
Well, it's an interesting system, and if you can do that, then there's obviously a lot of power in reducing the amount of human in the loop work you have to do. What are the sort of ultimate goals of people who are working on machine learning systems? Where do you want to see this in the farther future?
We'll continue to see machine learning playing an increasing role in robotic systems and in computer systems here on Earth. We may not see the words machine learning everywhere, because when it works really well, it's invisible,
right?
Like your search results, right? It just sort of, things tend to work. And under the scenes, there's quite a bit of statistical learning going on. My own goal for the future would be to really recognize that space exploration is, it's not just humans doing it, that it's going to be a partnership between humans and machines. And we need to come up with a strategy for space exploration, planetary exploration, that plays to the strengths of both humans and machines. So humans are fantastic at doing science, at interpreting data, at imagining what might have caused the environment to come out a certain way. The depth of understanding is far greater than anything we could ever replicate in silicon. Machines are really good at crunching numbers. And the other great thing about them is they can survive in vacuum, and
yes,
they weigh a lot less, and they don't, they don't have to go to the bathroom, and they drink sunlight, right? I mean,
that's right.
So there are other places they can go that humans can't, right? Mm-hmm. So there are these two complementary aspects of space exploration, and we've got to construct our exploration strategy with care so that we really play to the greatest strengths of both.
And, is it possible to imagine more and more tasks being passed off to the robotic side as they continue to improve?
I think what we're likely to see is increasingly sophisticated instruments and measurements that machines are capable of making. In the case of Aegis or TextureCam or dust devil detection, what we're doing is we're telling a machine very precisely what we want it to do, and then having it make, on our behalf, some reliable measurement that gives us better quality data from the environment over that narrow bandwidth link. I don't think we'll see an autonomous geologist robot on Mars anytime soon. I don't know that that's even a goal worth trying for.
Okay.
But if we can build a better measurement device with a little bit more intelligence than what we have now, I think that'd be a big step forward.
So it's intelligence with the goal of efficiency and effectiveness instead of replacement.
Absolutely.
So then we can imagine these future scenarios for space exploration and sharing tasks between humans and robots and playing to their strengths. But before we do any of that, we're going to have to do some more tests on Earth and continue to evolve those robotic technologies and these machine learning systems. And of course, you're doing some work with that in field testing of robots. What are you working on and what are you testing?
NASA has a broad portfolio of technology development. So they fund work not just for things that are going immediately to the next spacecraft, but also things that are a couple of decades out into the future. Looking at more fundamental technologies. So TextureCam is one example of that. There are other rover tests that you alluded to going on in the Atacama Desert. And this is a favorite location for geologists studying Mars just because it's so dry. There are places in the Atacama that have never seen rain in recorded history. And so it has a lot of the same characteristics, both in terms of terrain and in some places chemistry, of the Mars surface.
But it's easier to get to.
It's a little bit easier to get to, yeah. Of course, you don't have customs issues with Mars ever.
Right, of course.
So there are groups doing work in the Atacama Desert, and one project led by Carnegie Mellon will take a rover out there over the course of the next 3 years to do tests in science autonomy, among other things, in order to detect life under the surface. So this robot will have a drill, and it will drill at different locations to figure out what organisms might be alive under the crust of the Atacama Desert. There will be a science autonomy component to that, and we're working right now on a system that will give the robot a bit more intelligence about where to go, so that we'll actually be able to build up a map of its environment as it travels, and maybe make real rudimentary decisions about whether to go left or right in order to collect the most interesting data, or to stop for a little while longer than it normally would if it's in the middle of some spatial anomaly. For example, it notices that the wind is much stronger here, or there's some new material on the ground that it's never seen anywhere else, or perhaps its subsurface measurements have found something interesting. Cues like that would let it collect additional data that on the next downlink that would arrive at the scientist's doorstep and packaged with an ISPO.
That's an exciting idea, that you can teach a robot to make decisions based on integrating information that it gets from all of its different sensors in the environment and basically see, think, decide, and go.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. And also, I think, just being able to use these sort of analog environments on Earth to test where we want to go with robotics in the future.
It's critical, I think, because there are things one discovers in the field that you just don't think of when you're sitting in a laboratory, you know, staring at a screen. There's really no substitute for being out there in the wind and the open sun in order to really understand what the rover is seeing.
Well, thanks again for your time, and we look forward to seeing how these things continue to develop.
Yeah, well, thank you so much.
You are listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
So we just listened to that discussion with Dr. Thompson from JPL about how we can do image processing to enhance autonomy of spacecraft and the instruments thereon. And I think there's some really exciting developments that have recently happened and are starting to come in how we can get planetary spacecraft to make some decisions on their own, or at least to take large data sets and turn them into small ones with the same information.
I found this a really interesting interview to listen to because it kind of took me back to my PhD. And part of my PhD was to look through over 26,000 images of asteroids.
That's a lot of images.
It was a lot of images. Me not being a computer scientist, I mean, it took a long time for me to automate some of the process, but at some point I had to look at pretty much every image. And so, you know, hearing this and kind of looking back on my own experiences, I can really see, one, how important it is to do this and how hard it is to do it. And like he said, they're starting with their baby steps right now to get this going.
So these asteroid images, what were you looking for?
I was looking for evidence of cometary activity.
Okay.
So I was looking for either outgassing or some sort of expansion, and so it wasn't a point source. So I had things that could pick out things that obviously were not, but then I had cutoffs, right? And so I had to look at certain images that were
all the
within.
Marginal cases.
Yeah.
It is something that makes a lot of sense, and this is the sort of thing we're going to try with the data that comes back from MSL. We're going to try to process it, and those marginal cases, that's what gets kicked out. That's what we look at with our own eyes, because oftentimes with these marginal cases, there's something interesting going on.
That's right.
Now what I found really, really interesting about the interview was the question of how much autonomy do we want to give? Because it's not just about using this software to look over images we already have. We're talking about software that decides what's interesting and what to go and get.
Yeah, and how do you share?
How to prioritize it too.
Exactly. Like this question of how do you share responsibility and decision making between the landed robotic assets and the mission control? And perhaps if you have a human mission, between the machine, the astronauts, and the mission control.
Right, and there are different levels of that. I mean, one of the things he mentioned was, you know, instruct the rover to drive up to a rock and take pictures of the three most interesting things and send that back. And that's almost like a computerized grad student in a way, in that without even knowing what this rock looks like, this software has already prioritized areas of interest. And so the question is, where do you draw that line? Because there are a lot of places, obviously, that this work can help. I mean, people don't often realize exactly how much work and how much time, and let's face it, effort that could be perhaps better automated goes into just being able to touch things on other planets with the light-to-time delay.
Yeah, instrument placement is a major problem, right? Because it's not a question of take a picture of the rock and then tell the robot to put the APXS or something up against the rock. It's a much more complicated process of estimating exactly the distance and the position and the relative placement of that rock. You know, if you drive the instrument into the rock, it's over.
That's right. And one of the nice things is that you design instruments with this in mind. You design instruments that you can, you know, not only get them up to the rock, but you can push them against the rock without destroying them. If you need that fine placement, as some instruments in the future no doubt will, that gets to be more of an issue. You have to completely understand where you are and all of the factors before you can go ahead and do that operation safely. There are ways that you can maximize time, of course. For instance, the MER rovers pioneered something they like to call touch and go, where they actually drive up to a place, figure out where everything is that can be touched, and then the next day, touch it and rove off again. So it puts that dead time where you figure out what's going on between command cycles.
I kind of like this suggestion that Dr. Thompson made of, you know, comparing how machines are having to learn, how we're having to teach our machines to recognize things, with how humans themselves
have to learn.
I really like that too. And one example that comes to mind with humans is, you know, he was talking about how patterns are easily recognizable by adults. One thing that comes to mind is how often we can recognize the human face in things.
Right.
And examples are, you know, Man on the Moon, right? The yeah. face on Mars, you know, when people are seeing mm-hmm. Martin Luther King and a potato chip or something like
yeah,
that. And
right.
we're just so ingrained. It's so ingrained in our mind to recognize the two eyes and the nose and the mouth shape or pattern that we can just kind of pick it out anywhere. I can see it in the sockets on the wall or in the pattern of the books over there.
Or in a yellow circle with two dots and a curve.
Right.
Yeah, which is far less detail than you would expect to represent the face, but we have mm-hmm. that heuristic that somehow matches it up.
But so interesting that, like he said, that mm-hmm. babies and toddlers have such a huge problem with it, and then mm-hmm. that's kind of the stage that the machines are in yeah. right now.
Right, and figuring out how to get from A to B, it's something we don't entirely understand how that learning process works.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, there are people out there who were blind as children, got their sight back later as adults, and they have a lot of trouble with this because they didn't learn the skills back when they were younger. So,
it's almost like you need a psychologist or something like that to be working with the computer scientist. We don't have that side of things in planetary
yeah.
science about, you know, the psychological, how people learn, really.
Yeah.
And how to transfer that to
robotics. Understanding cognition is hard.
Yeah.
And I guess there's a question, how much do you need to understand it, or how much can you use it as a black box if you can build a neural network in software or something, as long as it works?
I mean, like he mentioned when he was talking about how to pick out the rocks, they would shade over the areas that mm-hmm. this is a rock, and this is a rock, and this is a rock, and then give
yeah.
it another picture and see if it would recognize the rocks.
Yeah, this is a common approach. You give it a training data that's been pre-labeled, and you know, you train it to use whatever parameters you give it as input, and it figures out how to weight them to recognize certain patterns and features. But then, a bit like putting a sedimentary geologist in an impact crater or an igneous environment, it won't be able to adapt to different settings unless you train it for that too.
That's right. I mean, like he mentioned with the orientation of a chair, right? We can
yeah.
recognize that that's a chair, but seeing it in a different setting or a different orientation, it can't do it, which is really interesting.
Yeah, intuition is a difficult thing, and it's certainly why we can't, at this stage at least, send a robot to a place like Mars and just leave it alone, tell it to bring us back some samples
mm-hmm.
and some images and some data. And it's interesting because I kind of posed that question during the interview. I asked, you know, how far can we imagine this go? And Dr. Thompson suggests that maybe even having a fully autonomous geologist is perhaps not a goal worth working towards. That, you know, we can make baby steps from here. We can make some more steps in the future. Maybe we need to play to the strengths of humans and robots and leave that decision with the humans.
That's right, because hopefully in the future we will be sending humans and robots out
yeah.
together, so why not use the strengths of both
yeah.
while you're doing that?
And I think trying to figure out how to divide the tasks between humans and robots will depend a great deal on, you know, how many robots you have and how capable they are and what your goals are. Like
mm-hmm.
if you just want prospectors, maybe you can send them out to just look for this one thing, and they don't have to interpret their environment and know everything.
Right.
They just have to find that thing with high enough reliability that it's productive. If you're trying to do science, detailed science, understand every little thing about the history of an environment, maybe that's a lot harder. There are a whole bunch of different scenarios that could play out.
Another thing he mentioned, too, was kind of the spin-off that have come off of this. For example, he mentioned search engines use the same kind of technology. And I actually looked up on the NASA spinoff site, and I guess there's this program. It was invented by Visual Learning Systems, which is a company, and they developed this program to address satellite information flow log jams. You know, the U.S. Border Patrol uses it to find trails along national borders. There are environmental companies that use it to monitor oil spills and that kind of thing. And so there's all these applications for this type of software, which you could imagine could go into medicine and really any place that uses any images of any kind.
Yeah, and actually medical imaging is a place where there has been some development in this kind of autonomous interpretation.
Yeah.
Things like finding tumors in radiograms or whatever, because they kind of have a similar appearance most of the time, and you can, it's the kind of thing that you want to do quickly, rather than have your small pool of radiologists spend lots of time poring over film.
Something I find very interesting about space travel and exploration and getting ready for this is how it forces us
to sort of figure out what all the components are for doing any simple activity that we wouldn't even give a second thought to on Earth. It really forced us to learn how it is that we learn. And that's a really fascinating thing.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Alyssa Gilbert and Michael Forster and featured an interview by co-host Raymond Francis. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Raymond Francis, Alyssa Gilbert, and John Moores. Our editors were Alyssa Gilbert, Raymond Francis, John Moores, and Michael Forster. And, as always, I'm Dr. John. You can continue the conversation online or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWAFM. And on Facebook, we are Western-Worlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope that you can make world enough and time for Western Worlds again next week, right here on Astronomy.fm.